The nurse signs the form, then pauses. The patient is eating breakfast, talking, not dying. The chart says hospice eligible anyway, 6 months or less. That box is checked. Somewhere else, a billing clock starts running. This is how hospice is supposed to work. Care replaces cure. Comfort replaces intervention. Medicare pays because the end is near. But in this case, the end is not near. The math is. Investigators would later question how a fast-growing hospice company tied to Seth Gilman enrolled patient after patient who did not meet terminal criteria. According to allegations in regulatory filings and reporting, growth targets mattered more than prognosis. Census numbers mattered more than decline. Families trusted the word hospice. Doctors trusted paperwork. Medicare trusted certifications. The system trusted the business. What happens when end-of-life care becomes a volume game and the people enrolled are not dying at all? The business of dying. The hospice industry was built on a promise. When treatment stops working and time runs short, care steps in. Pain is managed. Fear is lowered. Families are supported. Medicare pays because the end is supposed to be near. That promise became a business model. Over the past two decades, hospice care in the United States shifted quietly from nonprofit roots into a profit-driven marketplace. Medicare reimbursement made the math simple. Enroll a patient certified as terminal, provide routine care, bill per day. The longer the patient remains enrolled, the more revenue flows in. For patients who die quickly, margins are thin. For patients who live months or years, margins expand. Federal rules are clear on paper. Hospice eligibility requires a physician's certification that a patient is likely to die within 6 months if the illness runs its normal course. Recertifications are required at set intervals. Documentation must show decline. The benefit is not meant for long-term management or convenience care. In practice, the system relies on trust. Doctors sign forms. Nurses write notes. Hospice administrators submit claims. Medicare pays first and audits later, if at all. Oversight is limited. Reviews are often delayed by years. By the time patterns emerge, millions of dollars may already be gone. It was inside this system that a for-profit hospice operation linked to businessman Seth Gilman began to grow. Public records and reporting describe a company that expanded rapidly, increasing its patient census and revenue at a pace that outstripped regional norms. Growth itself is not illegal. Expansion is not proof of wrongdoing, but regulators and investigators would later focus on how that growth was achieved and who exactly was being counted as dying. Former employees, according to later allegations, described an internal culture where numbers mattered. Census was tracked closely. Admissions were celebrated. Discharges were discouraged. Patients who stabilized were not always removed from hospice roles. Patients whose conditions improved were still billed as terminal. At this stage, these claims were not proven facts. They were warning signs. Hospice workers are trained to look for decline, weight loss, reduced ability, increased pain, fewer good days. In legitimate cases, the trajectory is unmistakable. But decline can be subjective, especially for chronic illnesses, heart disease, dementia, lung conditions. These patients can plateau, they can rally, they can live far longer than 6 months. That gray zone is where abuse becomes possible. According to reporting that would later surface, admission staff were encouraged to insert eligibility generously. Diagnoses that allowed flexible prognoses were favored. Documentation was written to support terminal narratives even when day-to-day observations suggested stability. Language mattered. A patient was not stable. They were fragile, not improving, temporarily unchanged. Each word shaped reimbursement. Medicare paid a daily rate for routine hospice care, often exceeding $200 per patient per day. Multiply that by hundreds of patients, multiply again by months. The result was predictable. Revenue climbed steadily. Profits followed. What Medicare did not see in real time were the breakfast trays, the casual conversations, the patients attending family events weeks or months after enrollment. The system did not see those details. It saw codes. Within the company, according to later accounts, pressure flowed downward. Administrators tracked census targets. Regional managers reported numbers. Nurses were reminded that enrollment sustained jobs. Admission staff were rewarded for growth. Declines in patient count were questioned. Again, at this stage, these were allegations that had not yet been tested in court, but they formed a pattern investigators would later examine. Hospice care exists at an ethical edge. Staff are asked to balance compassion with compliance. Many nurses enter the field to help people die with dignity. When business goals intrude, moral lines blur. Do you discharge a patient who is stable and risk losing revenue, or do you keep them enrolled and justify it in the chart? According to accounts reviewed by regulators, some staff chose the latter. Early red flags did not come from a single dramatic event. They came from inconsistencies. Patients remaining on service far beyond expected timelines. Recertifications that repeated identical language. Charts showing decline without observable change. A census that kept climbing even as regional death rates remained flat. Regulators are not embedded inside hospice companies. They depend on audits and complaints. Complaints are rare. Families often trust providers. Patients are vulnerable. Staff fear retaliation. When concerns were raised, they were often internal at first. Questions about eligibility, discomfort with paperwork, warnings that certain patients did not meet criteria. In a healthy system, those concerns trigger review. In a profit-driven system, they can trigger silence. Medicare audits, when they occur, typically review a small sample of claims. A few dozen charts pulled months or years after billing. If problems are found, repayment may be demanded. But by then, executives may have moved on. Companies may have restructured. Money may already be spent. The lag creates opportunity. Public filings and investigative reporting later described how hospice companies nationwide learned to operate inside that lag. Aggressive enrollment first, defense later, appeal denials, negotiate settlements, treat fines as a cost of doing business. Whether Gilman's operation followed that same playbook would become a central question. At the time of its growth, the company presented itself as compliant, compassionate, and successful. Marketing materials emphasized care. Internal metrics emphasized volume. Both could coexist on paper. For Medicare, the distinction mattered deeply. Hospice fraud does not just waste money. It alters care. Patients enrolled in hospice typically forego curative treatment. They may stop seeing specialists. They may accept a narrative of imminent death that shapes decisions. Enrolling a patient who is not terminal changes the course of their life. Investigators would later examine whether that line was crossed deliberately or recklessly. At this point in the timeline, the question was still unresolved. What was clear was that the numbers told a story that did not align neatly with medical expectations. The business was booming, the census was strong, the payments were steady, and the system kept trusting the paperwork. By the time external scrutiny began to sharpen, the foundation had already been laid. A model that rewarded enrollment, a culture that normalized generous interpretation, a regulatory structure that moved slowly. The question hanging over the operation was no longer abstract. Was this hospice succeeding because it was providing end-of-life care to those who truly needed it, or because it had learned how to stretch the definition of dying? That question would not remain theoretical for long. Chapter 2, Patients Who Were Not Dying. The pressure did not announce itself loudly. It crept in through meetings, emails, and quiet reminders about numbers. Census was discussed more than decline. Admissions were praised more than discharges. Length of stay became a silent metric, even when no one named it that way. Hospice is supposed to follow the patient's condition. In the cases later questioned by regulators, according to allegations documented in reporting and filings, the condition often followed the business. Patients with chronic illnesses made up a growing share of enrollments. Congestive heart failure, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, dementia. These diagnoses allowed flexibility. Prognosis was not linear. Decline could be framed as imminent even when it was slow or absent. Former staff members would later describe being asked to justify eligibility rather than assess it. A patient who walked unassisted was described as frail. A patient whose weight held steady was documented as at risk of rapid loss. Language was adjusted to fit criteria. Each certification required a physician's signature. In many cases, those physicians relied on hospice-provided summaries. They did not see patients daily. They trusted the chart. The system allowed it. According to allegations, some nurses and social workers grew uneasy. They noticed patterns. Patients enrolled for months with little change. Families confused about why hospice had been initiated. Questions about whether curative treatments were truly no longer appropriate. Raising those concerns was not always welcomed. Internal accounts reviewed by investigators later described subtle retaliation. Staff who questioned admissions were sidelined. Assignments changed, advancements stalled. In some cases, according to allegations, employees were reminded that enrollment sustained the company and, by extension, their jobs. No memo said enroll the healthy. No meeting openly instructed fraud. Instead, incentives did the work. Admissions staff were evaluated on volume. Administrators tracked growth. Declines were framed as failures. The boundary between aggressive interpretation and misconduct blurred. Billing followed enrollment automatically. Medicare's routine home care rate flowed daily. The patient did not need intensive services to generate revenue. A nurse visit once or twice a week was often sufficient. The margin widened with time. According to analyses later cited by regulators, some patients remained enrolled far beyond the six-month expectation without documented decline. Recertifications repeated the same phrases. Prognoses stayed dire on paper while lives continued normally. Families trusted the process. Hospice carries emotional authority. Being told a loved one has 6 months to live changes how people behave. They stop pushing. They accept limits. Some later told investigators they were confused when time passed and nothing changed. At this stage, none of this had yet been proven in court. But the accumulation of complaints began to draw attention. Oversight bodies rely heavily on whistleblowers. Audits are reactive. When staff members or competitors raise alarms, regulators begin to look. In this case, according to public reporting, concerns reached state and federal agencies describing inappropriate admissions and billing practices. Investigators began reviewing charts. They looked for objective decline, weight loss, hospitalizations, increased medication, functional deterioration. In some files, they found none. Instead, they found stable vitals, routine daily activities, notes that contradicted conclusions. Patterns mattered more than any single patient. Investigators also examined how patients were sourced, referral relationships, marketing practices, financial incentives. While referral payments are illegal, subtler forms of influence exist. Educational partnerships, preferred provider arrangements. According to later scrutiny, enrollment growth appeared disconnected from community mortality rates. As scrutiny increased, internal tension rose. Employees described being asked to clean up charts, to add language, to clarify notes after the fact. Retrospective documentation is not inherently illegal, but when it alters clinical meaning, it raises red flags. The focus shifted from care to defense. According to accounts later cited in filings, staff meetings began emphasizing compliance in tone but not in substance. The message was to document better, not necessarily to admit differently. Eligibility lines remained flexible. Enrollment continued. Medicare's payment system compounds the risk. Claims are paid quickly. Appeals take time. If later denied, companies can contest findings. The financial downside is delayed. The upside is immediate. For a growing hospice, the incentive is obvious. Regulators also examined length of stay data. National averages show most hospice patients die within weeks or a few months. Extended stays occur, but they are less common. In the questioned operation, according to allegations, extended stays were routine. The implication was not just financial. Hospice enrollment often replaces other services. Patients may lose access to certain therapies. Their care path narrows. Enrolling someone prematurely reshapes their medical future. That reality weighed on some staff. Former employees later described moral distress. They entered hospice to help people die well. Instead, they felt they were managing people who were not dying at all. Some quit. Others stayed silent. A few spoke out. Those voices became central to escalating scrutiny. As complaints accumulated, oversight agencies moved from preliminary review to formal inquiry. Subpoenas were issued, records requested, patterns analyzed. The company was no longer operating unseen. Publicly, leadership maintained that all admissions met criteria, that hospice prognostication is imperfect, that extended stays occur naturally. These defenses are common in the industry and not inherently false. The question was whether the imperfection was being exploited. Investigators focused on internal communications, emails discussing census goals, messages encouraging admissions growth, training materials emphasizing enrollment techniques. None alone proved wrongdoing. Together, they suggested intent. The role of leadership became unavoidable. As the businessman associated with the operation, Seth Gilman became a focal point in reporting and regulatory interest. Investigators examined what executives knew and when, whether pressure originated at the top or emerged organically. At this stage, outcomes were still uncertain. No verdict had been rendered, no settlement announced, but the machinery of oversight was now fully engaged. What began as quiet discomfort inside charts had become a question of systemic abuse. Were patients enrolled because they were dying, or because their diagnoses could be made to fit? That distinction would define what came next. As investigators widened their scope and regulators sharpened their focus, the company faced a reckoning it could no longer delay. The numbers had drawn attention. Now the paperwork would be tested. Chapter 3. When the numbers catch up, investigations do not arrive all at once. They build quietly, file by file, chart by chart. What begins as a review becomes a pattern. What looks like coincidence turns into structure. By the time enforcement agencies move openly, months or years of activity have already been mapped. That was the stage reached when regulators and investigators turned fully toward the hospice operation tied to Seth Gilman. Federal and state authorities began examining billing records alongside clinical documentation. They compared diagnoses to length of stay. They looked at recertifications stacked back to back without documented decline. They analyzed revenue growth against patient outcomes. They reviewed internal communications where targets were discussed. This phase was no longer about suspicion, it was about proof. Investigators focused on whether Medicare had been billed for patients who did not meet hospice eligibility criteria. That determination rests on medical judgment, but patterns can override subjectivity. When hundreds of patients show similar discrepancies, judgment becomes harder to defend. Some cases stood out: patients enrolled for many months without hospitalizations, patients whose functional status remained unchanged, patients whose families reported surprise when hospice was introduced and confusion when it continued indefinitely. Each case alone could be explained. Together, they formed a profile investigators could not ignore. Regulators also examined physician certifications, who signed them, how often, whether the same language appeared across multiple patients, whether doctors relied entirely on hospice summaries or conducted independent evaluations. In some instances, according to allegations in filings and reporting, certifications appeared formulaic. Decline was asserted but not demonstrated. Prognosis language repeated with minimal variation. The investigation widened beyond charts. Authorities looked at corporate structure, ownership layers, management roles, financial flows, who benefited from sustained enrollment, how profits were distributed, whether compliance concerns reached executive leadership and how they were handled publicly. Company representatives denied wrongdoing. They emphasized the uncertainty inherent in end-of-life prognostication. They argued that hospice patients can stabilize temporarily. They framed audits as disagreements over medical judgment, not fraud. Those defenses are common. Sometimes they are valid. The question was whether they applied here. As scrutiny intensified, the impact spread outward. Staff morale declined. Some employees left. Others cooperated with investigators. Operations slowed. Admissions were reviewed more carefully. Discharges increased. Medicare, when fraud is suspected, has tools beyond repayment. Payment suspensions, exclusion from federal programs, civil penalties, in severe cases, criminal charges. The consequences extend beyond finances. They threaten the ability to operate at all. Patients and families were caught in the middle. Some families later told investigators they felt misled. They had accepted hospice because they believed death was imminent. When months passed, they questioned whether care had been appropriate. Others defended the services provided, saying hospice support improved quality of life regardless of prognosis. That tension complicates enforcement. Hospice is not a binary service. It exists in uncertainty. Abuse hides inside that uncertainty. Legitimate hospice providers watch closely. Fraud allegations stain the entire industry. When one company is accused of exploiting the benefit, regulators respond by tightening oversight for all. Audits increase. Documentation burdens rise. Care becomes more defensive. The fallout spreads. At the policy level, investigators examined whether Medicare's structure invites abuse. The flat daily rate, limited prepayment review, heavy reliance on provider honesty. These features were designed to encourage access, not police behavior. Critics argue they now enable exploitation. Some reform proposals gained attention: shorter initial eligibility periods, more frequent independent physician reviews, increased use of data analytics to flag outliers. None address the core dilemma: hospice requires trust. When that trust is weaponized, the damage is difficult to reverse. As investigations progressed, outcomes varied depending on jurisdiction and evidence. Some cases resulted in settlements without admissions of guilt. Others remained unresolved. In certain instances nationwide, hospice executives have faced criminal charges. In others, companies rebranded and continued operating under new structures. In this case, reporting described ongoing scrutiny and unresolved questions rather than a single definitive ending. That ambiguity matters. Allegations are not convictions. Investigations do not always lead to charges. But they leave records. They leave doubt. For Seth Gilman, the scrutiny reshaped public perception. What had been framed as entrepreneurial success was now examined through a different lens. Growth was no longer neutral. Profit was no longer separate from ethics. The larger consequence extended beyond one individual or company. Hospice patients are among the most vulnerable in the healthcare system. They are often elderly, cognitively impaired, or overwhelmed. They rely on professionals to tell them when hope has shifted from cure to comfort. That moment carries enormous weight. When that moment is manipulated, even subtly, the harm is profound. Medicare fraud is often described in dollars. Millions billed, millions recovered. But hospice fraud carries a quieter cost. It alters how people understand their lives and deaths. It changes decisions made in fear and trust. Regulators can demand repayment. Courts can impose penalties. None of that restores trust easily. As oversight agencies closed in, the case became part of a broader reckoning. For-profit hospice remains legal. Profit itself is not wrongdoing. But when financial incentives overpower clinical judgment, the line is crossed. Whether that line was crossed deliberately, recklessly, or systemically remains the core question investigators sought to answer. What is clear is that the numbers eventually spoke. Census growth drew attention. Length of stay raised alarms. Documentation failed to match reality. The lag between billing and oversight narrowed. The system that once trusted the paperwork began to challenge it. In the end, this story is not only about one hospice or one businessman. It is about what happens when care for the dying becomes a numbers game and oversight arrives too late. Hospice was designed to protect dignity at the end of life. When profit becomes the primary metric, dignity becomes collateral. And the cost is paid not just in money, but in trust that may never fully return.